ॐ अज्ञानात् निरञ्जस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कदामयं ददाति स्वापदन्तिकम् क्षमा ॐ विष्णुपदाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामिनीति नामिने नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे कौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष सन्निवादी पाश्चात्य देशचारिणे श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे पञ्चकौपत्रुभ्यश्च कृपा सिन्धुभ्येव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः हरे कृष्ण The topic is my journey with Japa. And as Yajna Purush Prabhu said, our journey is continuing right now. But to begin, I will go back to the first time I saw a devotee chanting. I think. I wasn't sure. I didn't know at the time he was a devotee, but later I understood he was a devotee. But I had come to the Bay Area in the summer of 1968, and I was walking along Haight Street, and I saw a tall fellow wearing robes with a shaved head, and I wasn't conscious of it at the time so clearly, but in retrospect I'm pretty sure he was chanting Japa. Then some days later I was on my way to do something that I thought was very important, and I saw a big crowd in Union Square, and I looked through the crowd and there were some devotees chanting Hare Krishna. And I paused. I was a seeker. I paused. But at the time I felt I had to get somewhere. And I also couldn't quite figure it out. Maybe I wasn't ready. And then, the next time was in April of, or March, end of March, 1969. I saw a poster on my campus. Lecture on Bhagavad Gita as it is, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. So I went, and after the lecture there was a kirtan in the hall. It was the auditorium. It was actually quite a nice auditorium. It had bare brick walls. It was just a style. And Sasrupa Maharaj led the kirtan. Srila Prabhupada was sitting on the stage. And the sound was just captivating. I mean, I really... Students were were getting up from their seats and going onto the stage and joining the devotees and dancing. And I also felt like doing it, but for social reasons. Not the usual social reasons, but some specific social reason. I contained myself. And then after the last kirtan, a devotee, might have been Satsarupa Maharaj, asked if anyone was driving, if anyone in the audience had a car and was driving to Harvard Square or to Boston. The devotees needed a lift. And I was going to Harvard Square and I did have a car. So everyone piled in. It was a red Rambler station wagon. Everyone piled in, and there was some discussion in the car, and I was very impressed. Actually, what Lady Devotee Janava Mataji was in the front seat. The men were like really piled in the back, and I was so impressed with her. I mean, I was looking for a guru, and I had met many swamis and yogis and masters, and she spoke with more authority than any of them. It's this young lady. But I could understand she could not be speaking with that authority on her own strength. You know, the authority must be coming from somewhere else, from her teacher. And I was very eager to meet him. So the next day I went to the temple, and Hansaduta Prabhu had come down from Montreal. Srila Prabhupada actually introduced him and said, you know, we are very honored today that one devotee has come all the way from Montreal, and now we will hear from him. And Hansaduta Prabhu spoke. And I didn't know, like, who was who at the time. But then eventually Prabhupada did speak, and I understood this is the main lecture. But Hansaduta also spoke very nicely. And then there was kirtan. There was kirtan, and it was very powerful. All the kirtans were so ecstatic. Devotees would just look forward to it and dance in ecstasy. So I started to come every day. And soon enough, someone told me about japa. And I began to chant, and I liked it. And, I remember just that little storefront, 95 Glenville Avenue, just chanting on my beads, and there are beautiful devotional pictures on the wall. And they looked like, not pictures, I mean, just like really, there was Krishna, there was Vishnu, there was the Panchatattva, there was Prabhupada. And I would chant. And I chanted pretty loudly. I wasn't like counting my rounds or anything, just chanting. And then they told me about rounds and how Srila Prabhupada said that if two of the senses are fixed, then the mind will be fixed, and therefore we chant on the beads, because the beads engage the sense of touch, and then we hear, that engages the sense of hearing, and if those two senses are fixed, then the mind will be fixed. Then eventually, It came time for initiation. I was initiated by mail, but still I had to send my beads. And the devotees told me, because in those days we didn't import beads from India, we would go to a bead shop and buy beads and string them. So one devotee told me that if you chant one mantra for each bead that you string, by the time you've strung the 108 beads, you'll be in complete ecstasy. So I did it, and what they said was pretty true. Pretty true. Then sent the beads, and in those days we would go on street chanting Harinam Sankirtan every day and distribute BTGs. And one day on Harinam, I don't know what happened, I just started to cry, you know, and just felt some spiritual force, some spiritual presence. And so I asked some devotees, and said, it could be that at that moment, Srila Prabhupada was chanting on your beads and giving you initiation. And then a couple of days later, you know, the beads came in the mail with the letter, and it seemed very possible. So, yeah, we didn't go out that much then. We would only go out, as I mentioned, with the Harinam party and BTGs. Later, devotees would go out with BTGs and books without the Harinam party. And we were a small temple, so usually we would just go out. Of course, yeah, the hours increased, we'd go out in the afternoon. So we had a lot of time to chant japa. So I, you know, pretty much had the whole morning. And it was very nice. So then, I was asked to go to India, which was a great... I mean, I think every devotee in the temple was hoping they would be the one. And anyway, I was the one from the Boston temple. And I always had a policy to chant 12 rounds before I did anything else. And I think this was sort of tested. I arrived in Bombay, and I was based in Bombay, and we put on the first Bombay Pandal. Then after the success of the first Bombay Pandal, Srila Prabhupada asked Tamal Krishna Goswami and me to go to Calcutta and do the first Pandal in Calcutta, which was the second Pandal in India. And so I did very well meeting people and speaking to them about Krishna consciousness and getting support. Tamal Krishna Goswami said, "You raise the money and I will spend it." So that's okay. That was fine with me. And it's funny, I never got into competition. I did, like a lot of BTGs before I went to India. And never got into competition. But in Calcutta, I got a souvenir book that was published for a function of a Mayavadi in India, the famous Mayavadi in India. And we didn't know anyone, so I just thought I'll just approach the people that gave him ads. But I had a very, I must go to every single person who gave to him and get them to give more to Krishna consciousness than they gave to the Mayavadi. And I think in the end we defeated. So that was very good. But then, after the Pandal, maybe it was even during it, but anyway, during that period, Tamal Krishna Goswami, he really wanted me to like make a lot of appointments. I think it was after the Pandal. I just had my own way of working. And my way of working was I had to do my 12 rounds before I did anything else. Because I felt I could do my other four, it wouldn't be too hard. But even then, sometimes it was a little hard. Later I heard Mahatma Prabhu say that Srila Prabhupada said, if you don't finish your 16 rounds by 10 in the morning, you'll be in anxiety for the rest of the day. And I could see that, because sometimes even those four little rounds that I left, it really got difficult, because you're just so busy. But anyway, at least if I did 12, I could function. If I didn't do 12, I just couldn't function. And Tamal Krishna Goswami wanted me to... He wanted me to start earlier. He didn't want me to be standing in front of the deities, chanting my rounds, when I could be making phone calls and making appointments. And I tried to explain, and said, you're just pretending you like to chant. You actually just want to avoid work. And I don't really even know how to assess that statement, but the fact is I couldn't function unless I did my 12 rounds. So then from Calcutta, eventually I went to Bombay. And the Juhu Project, that really was a struggle. I mean, that was a struggle. When Vaisheshika Prabhu said I stayed in Bombay through thick and thin, and then he said it got pretty thin, in my mind I was thinking mainly thin. I must say that it was almost impossible. It was very difficult to chant after the day began. It was very difficult. And so I would really... But it was the same thing. I would do what I could in the morning. But it was so intense sometimes, it wasn't like that, that I could just chant and then begin my work at 9 in the morning or 10. Sometimes you just... And then I would just have to squeeze them in. And... So that wasn't a good period in terms of concentrated japa. I mean, it was a wonderful period in terms of guru seva. But I would have, you know, I'd be chanting on the train from Santa Cruz to Church Gate, or, I mean, just, you know, fitting them in. And anyway, so I think I'll have to skip ahead because, So pretty much I continued that pattern, chanting in the morning. I always like, After Prabhupada left, I'd always like to chant in front of his deity in the temple room. And then in 1999, I had a health problem. I developed it in my travels, but I didn't realize that I had heart disease until I came to California. I was actually scheduled to be in California for 12 days as part of the tour. And, I had had these symptoms beginning. I had them in Mauritius, I had them in South Africa, I had them in India. But I had a very bad bout at Heathrow Airport on the way to America, but it just never occurred to me that it could be heart disease. But when I got to Santa Barbara, I realized I'd better find out what this is, and then I found out I really had to change my lifestyle. So I couldn't travel as much. Japa was about all I had. I wasn't living in a temple community anymore, and I would relish that japa. For some time, I moved down to Dana Point, Krishna Kirtan and Kadarpa Manjari. Let me use their apartment there, and they stayed at her parents' house, which was just across the street, because her parents were mainly living in Texas, and they just came once in a while to California. And she had a very nice altar with and I would just sit and chant in front of those deities. It was like really, really nice. Really nice. But during Prabhupada's presence, he had instructed me to write, and it was always in my mind that I had to write, but I was always too busy. So I thought, okay, this is the time. Seems to be some arrangement that will enable me to write. And then I found that the best time to write was early in the morning, which was when I would always chant japa. And then my japa was pushed to the afternoon. And being out of that routine of chanting in the temple room in the morning, chanting in front of the deities, I don't know, I guess it slipped a bit. And then I saw a letter by Mahatma Prabhu on the internet. Put an end to courtesy japa. And I read it. I thought, oh, this is very interesting. It's very interesting. And then, I don't know how it happened, but people kept mentioning Satchinandan Swami's book, The Nectarian Ocean of the Holy Name, which I had, but I'd never really read seriously, and it just kept coming up, so I thought, oh, this is very interesting, I should read it, and I started to read it. And then, His Holiness Niranjan Swami came to stay with me for some weeks or more, and I thought, oh, this is really a good opportunity, because he's such a serious chanter, and he has so much taste for the holy name, this is really a good chance for me. I can serve him. The Bhagavatam says that, by serving great souls, you develop their qualities. And first and foremost is the quality of attraction for chanting and hearing. And then, the idea for it had come earlier. Purusha Shukta Prabhu had sent out a letter, like, these people have volunteered to work to do something for the spiritual care initiative. And, you know, who would you like to team up with? So Satchinandan Swami and I spoke. We decided, well, we could team up with each other. So initially, the idea of the Ojai Japa retreat was that it would be near to me, because at that time, my travels were still very limited. And Satchinandan Swami and I would have a chance to be together. But that year, he got very sick, and he had to cancel his visit, and he sort of assumed that we would cancel our retreats. But Purusha Shukta Prabhu said, no, we don't want to cancel, we want to go through with it. And that retreat, and at that time, His Holiness Narendra Swami was still staying with me. And that was really a transformative experience. It was like the culmination of, you know, reading Mahatma's letter, reading Satchinandan Swami's book, chanting Japa with Naranjan Swami. Just an increased awareness of the importance of attentive chanting, offenseless chanting. And that retreat was a smaller group. It was all, at the time, they had the idea of having retreats for leaders. So they were all Prabhupada disciples. And it was like very intimate, and I learned a lot. And as Bhurijan Prabhu often used to say, the best way to learn something is to teach it. So by, you know, speaking about the holy name, I became more aware of some of the principles that we discussed, but which aren't always in the forefront of our consciousness. And it's also service to the holy name. That was my main idea. By serving the holy name, by participating in these retreats, I will get the mercy of the holy name. And I would say that the retreat, you know, was working up to the 64 round day. That's one thing we aren't able to do in a workshop. And the experience I had in the 64 round day was just profound. I mean, it was profound. I had experiences chanting that I had never had before. I mean, and things were just so clear about the power of the holy name, the efficacy of the holy name. But it also became clear to me, you know, how important the association was. And everyone, and that was another highlight. The next morning we shared our experiences of the 64 round day. And another important feature of the 64 round day was the Mona Vrata, not speaking. I cannot tell you how much time and energy was saved by not speaking. It was immense. It was immense. And I realized that apart from speaking, so much mental energy goes into thinking whether to speak or not, thinking what to say, thinking how to say it, then after having said it, thinking how the person took it. if I have to adjust what I said because the person might not have taken it the way I wanted. And that's the one side. The other side is worrying that someone might speak to me while I'm chanting and interrupt me. And then if they say something that I don't like, then my mind is going to be distracted. Even if they say something I like, my mind might be distracted. So, besides the time actually spent speaking, a tremendous amount of time and mental energy goes into thinking about speaking and reacting to people speaking to you or reacting to the way they reacted to you speaking to them. And that was really good. And we would see each other. It was a beautiful grounds in Ojai. So one could easily walk through the woods and be alone, or one might cross paths with devotees. Earlier, I was more in that mood to be in the woods, but later I found I got great strength chanting in the hall that we had established as the temple in the association of the other devotees. And, you know, as it got closer to the 64, you know, like 56, 58, 60, it was like more and more realizations, more and more realizations. And by the end of 64, you know, there had been some profound experiences. And then the next morning we shared them. And that night we had kirtan. That's another nice thing about the retreats, that there's kirtan every evening from 7 to 9 or so. That's wonderful as well. So Ravindra Swarup Prabhu had come for that, and I really wanted to have his association, so we sort of agreed that after the retreat he would come to my place and spend the night, you know, time there. And it was my... It's a doctor's order. I have to walk an hour a day. So then the question was, what do we do during our walk? And we chant japa. And he said that... He's learned how to walk and actually hear when he chants. Now the tendency is that sort of the scenery is in the foreground and the japa's in the background. But he said it is possible to walk and the japa's in the foreground. But you have to make an effort. So we did that. We spoke a lot. He also had wonderful realizations. Wonderful realizations. And one thing he mentioned in the retreat, and it's something he's mentioned on other occasions, is that some years ago, maybe 20 years ago, it struck him that we really have to hear when we chant. It seems obvious now, with devotees writing books and conducting seminars, that we're meant to hear. But it actually took a while. You know, many devotees, they just get in the habit of chanting, but not really making a serious effort to hear. And I mean, first is to pronounce. Pronounce it and sit properly, different techniques that we'll learn. But the conclusion is to hear. And when he started to do that seriously, he started experiencing an overwhelming sense of sadness. And from the time he joined, he had heard, you know, chant and be happy. That's almost our motto, chant and be happy. And he was chanting very seriously, and he was feeling an overwhelming sense of sorrow. And he started to wonder what was happening. But he couldn't tell anyone because he thought he was doing something wrong. He thought we're supposed to chant and feel happy. Everyone else is chanting and feeling happy. So as he said, this was like his dirty little secret that he didn't want to share with anyone. And then after some days, he had a profound experience of sorrow. And at the bottom of it, he had a realization that the sadness had come from being separated from Krishna. That he had at some stage turned away from Krishna, and that it had nothing to do with anything wrong in Krishna, anything bad in Krishna. He had the realization or the perception that Krishna was perfect, and that his turning away from Krishna was his fundamental mistake. And then he realized that this realization was a result of his chanting, that he understood his fundamental mistake. And after that, his whole focus became, you know, how to restore his relationship with Krishna. And his japa was the means to that. And I also had some experiences. One, actually, I was chanting at the beach, and that was when Purusha Shukta was staying with me. He stayed with me for a week in Santa Barbara. And I thought it's not a coincidence that I had that experience when he was there. I thought, you know, he's serving the holy name, I'm serving him. The holy name is pleased, and so the holy name gave me some mercy. And so I was chanting on the beach and sitting and chanting. And I was somehow just feeling everyone's pain. It began with some individuals, but at the beach it extended to all the creatures at the beach. And, you know, from a superficial point of view, oh, it's very nice, you're sitting on the beach and there's the pelicans and there's the sandpipers. But I wasn't seeing it like that. I was seeing that the souls in these bodies are full of anxiety. They're full of anxiety. And they're struggling for existence. You know, see the pelicans, they're flying high, then they swoop down. They're looking for fish to eat. You know, it's like a kamikaze dive, trying to get some fish to eat. And they do it. They make all the effort. I don't even know if they get the fish. You know, they probably don't even know if they'll get the fish. But they have to keep doing it, otherwise they'll starve to death. And you know, at one stage I looked down and my left hand I saw there was a little ladybug. And it was the same thing. This creature is struggling for existence. And it was like overwhelming. I was thinking, like, I don't think I can take this. I can't take the volume of the pain and anxiety of all these living entities, you know. And then, and I was, at the same time I was chanting, you know, as attentively as I could, just feeling it, just an unbearable burden of the pain of all these living entities. And then I had a realization. It reminded me of Ravindra Swarup Prabhu's, although it's a little different. My realization was that my fundamental mistake is wanting to take the place of Krishna, you know. And I thought of that, we hear it all the time, but at that moment I felt it, and even now I do when I think of it. That Krishna is, he is in the heart of all these living entities. He's in the heart of the pelican, he's in the heart of the sandpipers, in the heart of the dog, he's in the heart of the human being, he's in the heart of the insect. He really loves them, and that's why he stays with them through all different situations. He loves them more than I do. And not only that, he has the power to really do something for them. Even if I'm aware that the pelican is suffering, the sandpiper is suffering, the dog is suffering, the man is suffering. Oh yeah, the dolphins are seeing dolphins. The same thing. It's the hard struggle for existence. It looks very pretty. Oh, dolphin. That's just like the facade, you know, underneath it's the hard struggle for existence. And I realized that this is also, you know, part of taking the place of Krishna, wanting to be the best friend of the living entities. Krishna is the best friend of the living entities. And that's part of attaining peace. Suridam Sarvadehinam, that when we realize that Krishna is the best friend, then we attain peace. And yeah, it was, well, that was a more recent experience. But I do think of that experience, and there have been others. But I think I'm making the point here that when we chant seriously, when we chant attentively, we may have profound experiences, but the profound experiences are not always easy or pleasant in ordinary terms. They can be difficult. It can be horrifying. And it reminds me of one disciple who told Srila Prabhupada that he thought that he had better qualities before he joined than after he joined. And he was naming all these things, you know, that were coming up in him. And Prabhupada said, it's like you live in a house and you haven't cleaned it for years and all the dust is settled, but you don't see it because it's all settled. And then you decide to clean the house and then suddenly all this dirt, all the dust is flying up. It's like you think, oh my God, the house was cleaner before I started the process of cleaning it. So, you know, Ceto Darpano Marginam, chanting is a process of cleansing. And part of the process of cleansing is that dirt comes up. You see it. You have to face it. And then it, then you expel it. The way it works. I'll end with on a different note, and again I'm emphasizing my recent experiences, but almost for the month of, almost for the entire month of June, His Holiness Indradumya Swami stayed with me. And during that period, we had a bit of a hot spell. I mean, not terribly hot, but it was hot. So it was pleasant to chant in the evening. And last December, in October I went to India, and then in December I went to Jagannath Puri. It's the first time I'd been back to India since my surgery. And I really had a wonderful experience in Puri. And one of the main reasons I went was I wanted to get Haridas Thakur's mercy. People would chant the holy name. But this place where I was walking, it's called Butterfly Beach, Montecito, it reminded me so much of Puri. Just exactly. They did some renovations there. It reminded me so much of Puri. And it was wonderful. And then there's like this huge mansion. But that was the only thing that was in Congress. Everything else seemed like Puri, but I couldn't like get it out of my mind that this is just some rich man's mansion. And then suddenly it clicked. This is like Ramananda Rai's palace, just near the Jagannath temple. And it's really very similar. I mean, and then it's like it all fit. And then, and that was a very good time to chant because there's no one there. And no cars, nothing, but safe. And then at that time you would see the moon rising over the ocean. It just reminded me of all of Mahaprabhu's pastimes in Puri. And it was really wonderful, really wonderful job. And I was sort of at the end of my walk, at the end of my rounds, and I didn't think there was anyone else there. And this young man, I couldn't even see him because it was sort of dark. He came up and said, you know, hi. Then he wanted to talk. And I was thinking, you know, should I or shouldn't I? And I said, well, you know, I have a certain quota of chanting that I have to complete, and I still haven't completed it. So maybe, you know, maybe I should keep chanting. Well, you know, whatever you want. You know, whatever you want. But from that, I could see that he wanted to talk. I said, but if, you know, I could always finish them later. And I could talk to you now. I said, well, no. Okay. So I spoke with him. Turns out he's like 18 years old, an art student, and discussed God a bit, you know. But it went on, you know, for about 20 minutes. And then, you know, I really wondered, am I ever going to see him again? What's going to come of this time I spent with him? Should I have spent this time just chanting? And after we parted and I went back to my japa, it was better than it was before I began to talk to him. And it was already pretty good by my standards. And the japa, the whole thing, it was really, that moment was like being in Jagannath Puri. It was really like being in Jagannath Puri, and the chanting, really relishing the chanting. And then I realized that, you know, the holy name is pleased when we give ourselves to others. It's always both, that we are attentive to our own personal practices, especially japa, but we also extend ourselves for the sake of others. And by being attentive in our personal practices, we get more potency when we speak to others. And by speaking to others, you know, in the right mood, we get more mercy from the holy name. And the two support each other. Then, maybe 3 days later or something, chanting the same place, it's going really well. And I learned, many of the things that I've heard in the japa workshops and retreats were things that I did on my own, just sort of intuitively, but I never realized that they were techniques or that there were principles involved. They're just things I did. But one thing Mahatma Prabhu said at the last workshop in Houston is that if your eyes move, you cannot concentrate. He did a very simple exercise, like you try to focus on something and you move your eyes around and your mind becomes distracted. And if you keep your eyes fixed on whatever it is, a candle or, you know, you just pick something in the room and then try to fix your mind on whatever it is, you can do it. So I was walking, and whenever I would go more deeply into chanting, my eyes wouldn't move. You know, I'd just be chanting and moving along. And although there weren't many people there, I perceived, when I got almost to the end, that there was a group of people coming. So I thought, you know, should I move my eyes or not? should I break the magic spell? But the thing is, it was already broken, because from my peripheral vision, I could see there was a group of people coming. So this thought within my mind means the spell was already broken. But I girded myself, okay, I'm just going to keep my eyes fixed, I'm not going to look up. And the group approached very close, and one lady of the group looked at me. I mean, I wasn't looking at her at that time, but very loudly she said, "Hello." But, you know, I couldn't get what her expression was, because sometimes, like, if you're talking to someone and you think they're not getting it, you say, "Hello, anybody there?" So I didn't know if she was, I couldn't see if it was that or whether it was like, you know, "Hello, there's a whole world out here, it's not just, you know, the 2 feet in front of you," or whether it was, "Hello, I'm seeing a devotee," or even if she didn't know a devotee, "I'm seeing a monk, you know, I'm seeing a man of God, hello." So then that was on my mind. What did she mean by that? But it was more than that. It was like, what is Krishna trying to tell me? That's what I was thinking. What is Krishna trying to tell me through her? So then I thought, maybe, because as it is, this whole contemplation, should I look up, and that, I'd already lost my concentration. So instead of, like, accepting and rejecting, I can just look up, and I can even say hello, and go back to my job. It'd be better than what I just went through. So that was sort of a good lesson. And then it just so happened that when I reached the end, I turned around to go back, and coming up, the same group was, and again she smiled and said hello, and that time it was like just completely friendly, just full of appreciation, and so this is a point that we'll come to in our more philosophical discussion, that one shouldn't the cultivation of renunciation isn't really part of the practice of bhakti. I mean, one becomes detached as a natural result of bhakti. One loses taste for, you know, pale, dead, material things when one experiences the higher taste of the beauty of Krishna. So that, it was a small incident, but it did teach me a lesson. Shouldn't, like, I guess, not move my head. And it's worked better. You know, if it does happen, I look up. If they smile, I smile. If they say hello. Yes, yesterday, two people said Hari Bol. But I wasn't hung up. I just said Hari Bol back and went on with my job. And Hari Bol literally means chant the holy name of Hari. So I followed their order and chanted the holy name of Hari.